Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Our reading this morning is the story of the wise men from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising, and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all of Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem, Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod secretly called for the wise men, and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there, ahead of them, went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed by joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road.
Magic magi, some people call them wise, for Oriental, even kings, well anyway, those guys. They visited Jesus, they sure enjoyed their stay. They had warned in a dream of King Herod's scheme, they would hope by another way.
I'm really grateful this week too. There's a magazine I subscribe to called Homiletics, and they had a prompt for preaching this story, and I learned something that I didn't know about before. I never tire of finding out backstories to art and to music. That is always really intriguing to me. Does anyone know the story of a painting that's by Leonardo da Vinci called The Adoration of the Magi? I just wonder if you've already heard this story, right? I'm gonna tell it again. The preacher in the room knows the story. That's cool. So there it is. One version of it anyway. Let's keep it there. That's Mary with baby. And the kneeling people are the Magi. This was done in 1480. Or at least it was commissioned. And it was begun. Da Vinci agreed to paint this 8 foot by 9 foot. The size of it. And it was agreed upon that he would paint it for the front altarpiece of a church called San Donato a Scappetto. It's actually a monastery. So he started painting this, and then he left town. And he didn't come back. So what you see there for right now, actually, and she's going to leave it up there, is an unfinished painting. Now, there are lots of paintings, classical paintings, showing the Magi crowded into the stable of Jesus' birth, along with animals and shepherds and an angel, and Mary and Joseph and the baby. And that's how the art puts it together. But like I said before we sang that song, the Magi most certainly really arrived years later, more like 2 years later. And maybe that's why in the Gospel of Matthew that Sarah just read, it says they entered the house. It says they entered a house. They didn't say they entered the stable. So we're hoping Joseph and Mary found some better accommodation over those 2 years. Imagine raising a two-year-old stable. Oh my gosh. That would be really hard. So whenever, however it really happened, these Gentile visitors from the East came and knelt down once they got there and paid him homage. And I think it's worth noting that they're Gentiles, strangers, non-Jews. That's Matthew's, the writer of Matthew's from the beginning. It's what he wants us to remember and to know, that God comes to all of us, not just the chosen ones, but to all of us. So these Magi were outsiders. And they adored the baby Jesus, and they did what they came to do, and then it was time for them to return to Herod and make a report, because he had sent them there to find this child king. It was his turn to go home and close the deal, but like Da Vinci, or their turn, they decided on some level, I think, to actually not quite finish up what they set out to do. And they don't exactly, they go home, but they don't go home the same way they came. And actually, as far as we know, they don't make a report, really, even. We actually never hear about them again. They never reappear in the story. Now, I said that the artist Da Vinci had been commissioned in 1480 to paint this 8x9 foot work for the main altar of the monastery, right? It was near Florence. He was 29 years old at the time, just to, because the pictures of him don't say 29 years old, do they? 29, just some of us need to remember where we were at 29. Some of us aren't there yet. And he worked on it for quite some time. And so what we see here is in brown ink, and it's called yellow ochre. And it's into the canvas. That's how they painted back then. But he left and moved to Milan and never worked on it again. And eventually the assignment for this was given to another artist who provided the requested painting to the monastery in 1496. And Da Vinci's unfinished work still exists and is on display at a museum in Florence. And it's uncompleted like this. But even though it's uncompleted like this, it is seen as one of his most important works of art. And there are a few surprises about this painting. So we're going to show a short video. It's a little hard to hear at first. There's other things going on in the lab. This is Dr. Eric Frost from San Diego State University's Visualization Center. So listen to what he says about this painting.
One of the things that's a huge blessing in coming to San Diego is Maurizio Cersei, who actually did the imaging. Yes, he did the imaging. He looked at painting for the real color, and then the infrared, and then ultraviolet. And simply then, by doing all three of them at the same time, you can look through the painting to see what's under it. And that was a huge surprise to see if there's something under the paintings. When Leonardo was commissioned by an art patron to paint the painting, because the Adoration of Magi, so you can say Jesus, Mary, Joseph, and yet when people look at the painting, it's not the same quality as the rest of his paintings. So when Leonardo was doing the imaging, as he imaged underneath the painting, he discovered that there's a whole drawing underneath. And the un- underneath is the infrared painting or picture of the charcoal that Leonardo actually used to draw it. And then, much like paint by numbers, the painting was done on top of the drawing. It is an example. You can look at the horse that's right here. There are more portraits in this picture than any of the other Leonardo's. And the thing that's extraordinary about his creativity is that this is all done with no erasing. So this is how somebody drew it, versus if you just look at the natural. The natural is nothing like it in quality. Or another piece of looking at this part of the painting, it's really not much there at all. It's of interest. Yet if you fade off, all of a sudden you see that the drawing underneath has all these people that are there. And those people are doing motion. That was when Leonardo was testing on motion. And they were rebuilding this temple that's here that has lunations on it that were typical of Egyptian pagan religions. And so it turns out that Leonardo was drawing a metaphor. And so he was drawing the battle with the people. Drawing the resurgence of pagan religions in Christ's time. And the person that paid the bills didn't want that. So he fired him. And so somebody else came in and drew over the top of it and got rid of all the stuff he didn't want. And so now when you look under the painting, you actually see what Leonardo's real creativity is. And that's a huge contribution Maurizio has done, is we now look under the painting and we see what's really there.
I researched, and I couldn't really find out whether he was fired or whether he just left. I think that's intriguing. I think it's intriguing that he wanted to tell a fuller story than what actually ended up being painted. Let's look at there's the finished version by another artist, and very little of that, I mean, the understory is not there. Isn't that something? Wouldn't it be amazingly phenomenal if our unfinished projects in our lives were considered as important as his unfinished yellow or black and white? Let's see that little one again. Look at the difference. And this is the one that's considered a work of art. Not really the other one. We can leave that up there. Imagine everything that we could let go of in our life if we just said, it's not finished. Not like, it's not finished, but more like, it's not finished. It's never going to be finished, but it will be extremely valuable. I don't know to whom. But it will be. Now, probably that's not going to happen. I shouldn't really judge you that there's not a Leonardo da Vinci in the room. That's not really fair. Because I don't know everyone here.
Thank you.
I shouldn't leave that one coming. He was an artistic genius. But even if we were Da Vinci sitting here, what would we be known for? Do we want our unfinished products to be our contribution to the world? Are we ready for that? I also found out during this prep that, which I didn't know, Da Vinci is really known for unfinished works. Like getting bored when it's almost done and needing to go on to the next thing. I didn't know that about him. And so to have that kind of reputation where he would devote months and months to a concept and a composition of a work, but it seems like the appetite for carrying it out just kind of peters out. It's a good thing that the Magi didn't follow quite that closely to Da Vinci, because by all accounts, they sort of finished their job, the Magi. They took a long trip, they finished that. They followed the star, they finished that. They found where Jesus was. They fell down on bended knee and adored. They finished all that part. But then what happened? I have to wonder, since they go home by another way, did they actually feel finished? Did they actually feel finished inside? One preacher, Peggy Michael Rush, describes it this way. I like how she says this. Perhaps the wise men thought, what am I going to tell my wife? That the hope of my journey, the star of my life, the fulfillment of all my hopes turned out to be a boy in his terrible tubes. Think about that for a minute. How would you report that? Because they all told they'd be gone 4 years. 4 years they left their family behind. Maybe they were laughing to themselves, anticipating their arrival home. I don't know. But they, at any rate, got off their knees and headed out together, bonded by this shared dream, a crazy vision, and a powerful otherworldly experience that they never, maybe ever, really be able to get across or explain to anybody else. But maybe that counts as being finished. Maybe that counts. The first night that they slept there near Jesus, they all had a common dream. Sarah read it for us, where this angel warns them not to go back the same way, but to go home by another way. Don't go back to Herod. Don't tell him anything. Forget the directions that you know. Change your plans midstream. Let go of what you know to be true in your life. Maybe that's what happened to Da Vinci. Maybe that's what happens to some of us, too. We have projects planned, and we're going along, and things start shifting out there, and unexpected hurdles or judgments come up. In my home, I live with a general contractor. We call those change orders. They happen all the time. Mark will open up a wall that looks perfectly fine on the outside, right? Drywall. Changes everything. The cost is part of it, but the schedule alone, right? Didn't expect that shift. Or maybe it's more like this. We know that we need to be home to help with math homework or an English essay, in my case. But things at work just keep going longer and longer and longer. And we don't expect that. We have to change. Or maybe we have every intention of offering a beautiful, well-thought-out, crafted, planned Christmas Eve worship service, for example. And we plug in the Christmas trees and all the circuits blow in the church. And then they blow again. And then they blow again. And again. And again. That really happened. Or we know that we have accomplished and completed the blueprint group. You heard Matt talk about that. And Tim and Melissa, or in older case, Katie, has invited us to try out the kitchen table. It's time. But first, you know, it was Thanksgiving, and then Christmas was coming. We just kept thinking space would open up in our schedule, and, right, shifts. Shifts happen. Or maybe it's more like it's your daily new commitment, your faith project. Your intention to begin every day with prayer. But your daughter wakes you up at 6:15 every day. What do you do then? What do you do then? You'll pray at night. Dang, I'm tired at 9. I got up at 6:15. If we want to root our lives in grace and grow in faith, we have to eventually, though, find a way. Another way. To follow through with our intentions, to do good, to do no harm, to stay in love with God. To follow through on our yearning to know God, to follow God's star. And it means we have to find ways to keep our spirits up through our projects, hold our intention, even when our energy or our resolve is flagging. In the face of things going wrong, we have to try, as Christ saying, another way.
that might lead to a surprise discovery, a new path, a direction we've never even gone before. Because the journey of faith takes perseverance. In Blueprint, we talk about it in three ways. We talk about grace. And we use the metaphor in that case of a house. And we say that God's prevenient grace, which goes before us and is available as God's free gift of love, is like standing on the porch of a house. There's nothing expected of us. There's nothing to do but just be and sip our iced tea. But when we choose to enter the house and to walk through the front door, it's a different kind of grace. We call that justifying grace. And it's our yes then to God's yes to us. And we ultimately make our home there, many of us. We take up residence. I love that one person said in Blueprint one time, I put my bags down, it's time to unpack. Right? That's called sanctifying grace. And that whole process can happen quickly for some folks, but in our experience, that's not it. It takes time. It's an evolution of faith and faithfulness. There's an ebb and a flow, an in and an out. And one of the signs that we're growing in faith is just that we realize that we're easy on ourselves, a lot easier. And we simply understand that following Jesus is not a one-time commitment. It resembles a marriage in that way. It's ongoing. It requires work and more work in order for it to be healthy and alive. Eugene Peterson, he's a writer and a speaker, and he wrote and translated a version of the Bible called The Message. Maybe you've heard of him. He wrote about this, and he borrowed a phrase from the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. He described Christian life like this, as a long obedience in the same direction. He went on to say, one aspect of the world that I have been able to identify as harmful to Christians is the assumption that anything worthwhile can be acquired all at once. And we assume that if something can be done at all, it can be done quickly and efficiently. Get it done. Quick, quick, quick. Our attention spans have been conditioned by 30-second commercials. Those even seem too long, you know, especially on YouTube. Our sense of reality has been flattened by 30-page abridgments. There's a great market for religious experience in the world, and there is little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue, and little inclination to sign up for the long apprenticeship in what earlier generations of Christians called holiness. Founder of John Wesley had holiness clubs. So we just want to take a few more minutes to think about. You know, we're standing right here, the beginning of a new year, chronologically a new year. It's kind of a good time to maybe think about this. Think about the faith projects that are before us. A lot of us have already made our deep commitments for the year. And they're going to be coming to you in the mail in the next week or so to remind you of what you said. We want you to revisit those. How will you, or have you, made a commitment to root your life in grace and to grow in faith and to reach in love in 2014? How are you going to do that? What's your next step in each of those areas? When you get it in the mail, or if you haven't done it, we have cards in the back. You can fill one out today. You need to know just your next step. What's keeping you from taking that step if you already know what it is, or implementing it, or putting it in place? Hard one. Is there an area that is, you've already written these out or you're thinking about it and it's already falling apart for you? Already waning. Because let's be honest, it happens. What negative comments need to be ignored We hear more and more about people who are friends of many of you in this room who get this, really? You go to church? Like a church? That could feel negative. You might have to stand up for yourself on some fashion. What positive encouragement do you need to put in place? What challenges are actually indications, though, that you're on the right track? Who do you need to talk to about any of your goals? Have you shared them out loud on your kitchen table? Maybe some of you are already well on the way, making great progress. Finally, it's been easier, finally, than you ever thought. I was with someone this week. This was the first year that they didn't have to make the same resolution. Because last year, they really worked through some stuff. It's amazing to be on that side of it. The Magi stayed with their intention to follow the star, but they did find another way home. Having encountered the incarnation of God, they had to make some course corrections. But they still got home, or so it says. How are we going to make course corrections? How are we going to make our way through this year? Because like the Magi, we long, I think, to find God. And we here in this room are trying to find God through knowing Jesus. And we want to keep moving forward with that. And when we find Him, it doesn't mean that we have it all figured out, okay? It means that once we have seen and heard the good news, a lot of us also have to go back in some fashion to where we came from. And live differently. Because we love those people. But we've been transformed. And I know it's easier said than done. I know that. It was really noteworthy to me that Da Vinci, in the painting, that the professor talked about parts that never got painted, that are under the surface. Underneath our final version, glossed over me, objected to by the church, just too what? Real? I get that all the time. But too much. So that pretty version, can we see that one? So-called pretty. See that? All perfect. So we're seeing this painting, but we're not really seeing it, are we? And the presence of Jesus in our lives is a lot like that. Because the actual encounter with Jesus affects us on layers, in multiple ways, not just on the surface. It's how we use our money. It's what we spend it for. It's how much we give away. It's how we operate at work. It's how we treat our family. It's how we deal with our friends, our strangers that come in contact. It's how we prioritize our time, effort, and energy. I could go on, but I'm not going to. Instead, I'm going to ask Matt to close us. Because there's a poem about it, but I can't read it.
This is a poem from a United Methodist pastor in Florida who recently lost her husband. Her name is Jan Richardson. And the poem is called A Blessing for Women's Christmas. There is so much I want to say, as if the saying could prepare you for this path. As if there were anything I could offer that would make your way less circuitous, more smooth. Once you step out, you will see for yourself how nothing could have made you ready for this road that will take you from what you know now to what you cannot perceive, except perhaps in your dreaming or as it gives a glimpse in prayer. But I can tell you this journey is not about miles. It is not about how far you can walk or how fast. It is about what we will do with this moment, this star that blazes in your sky, though no one else might see. So open your heart to these shimmering hours by which your path is made. Open your eyes to the light that shines on what you will need to see. Open your hands to those who go with you, those seen and those known only by their blessing, their benediction of the road that is your own. Amen.